Hangar on Art is a radio program that investigates, experiments, inquires into art practices and critical theory as an extension to the Hangar Exhibitions, Residencies, Education and Research Program. The program sets a dialogue of a wide range of relationships which are established between artists, theorists, curators and researchers. Hangar on Art will feature thoughtful reflections, creative interventions, and thematic analysis.
So, hello, welcome to Hangar on Art, to Angela Ferreira. Let me introduce you first a bit. So, Angela Ferreira is born in 1958 in Maputo, Mozambique. She grew up in South Africa and obtained her MFA from the Michaeli School of Fine Art, University of Cape Town. She lives and works in Lisbon, teaching fine art at Lisbon University, where she obtained her doctorate in 2016. Ferreira's work is concerned with the ongoing impact of colonialism and post-colonialism on contemporary society, an investigation that is conducted through in-depth research and distillation of ideas into concise and resonant forms. She represented Portugal at the 52nd Venice Biennale in 2007, continuing her investigations into the ways in which European modernism failed to adapt to the realities of the African continent by tracing the history of Jean Prouvé's Maison Tropicale. In Dalaba, Sol d'Exil from 2019, a work focused on Miriam Makeba, one of the most prominent figures in the struggle against apartheid, Ferreira created sculptural pieces based on the architectural elements of the exile building where Makeba lived in Conakry, almost like a prototype of the relationship between modernist and African vernacular architectures. Hangar opened in June 2021, Angela Ferreira's sole exhibition, a spontaneous tour of some monuments of the African architecture, curated by Bruno Letao. So, welcome, Angela Ferreira.
Thank you.
My name is Jifa Peters. I am a German-Ghanaian visual artist myself and also a researcher. I'm a PhD candidate here in Lisbon at Universidad Católica. And yeah, it's great to meet you.
Nice to meet you too, Jifa.
Can you give us a short, maybe, introduction again about your artistic practice? What is, so to say, the foundation of your artistic work? And would you really place it at the intersection of art and architecture? And what is the relation to modern architecture and colonialism in your work?
Right. Well, so there was a lot of questions in one there. So let me see if I can unpack it. And then if I don't answer all of them, you can maybe come back to the spaces that I've left in between.
Sure, sure.
So I suppose the driving force, you know, going back to my early days as just finished art school, and beginning to work as an artist in South Africa, I guess the driving force behind my work was threefold. On the one hand, I had a strong sense of a need to marry a political discourse, which at the time was obviously centered in my ambitions to participate in the struggle against apartheid. And at the same time, to let my practice as a contemporary artist not be pamphleteering or propagandistic or simplistic, or rather, I should say it in a different way. I was interested, I as much as I was cynical about Western contemporary art and the Western world and the market value of contemporary art, I was also at the same time in awe of its kind of intellectual pursuit. And I was always very early on interested in thinking. Mm-hmm. And so I guess one of my biggest driving forces as I left art school and started dwelling on how I could, I was not the kind of student that, you know, I left art school and I already knew what I wanted to do. It was all kind of finish art school and then restart again. Like mm-hmm. now my artist practice starts. And what was quite clear from early on was that I wanted to be integrated in a contemporary art discourse, and the Western art discourse was the one that I most admired. Not that I didn't admire others completely, but that I also wanted my practice to be African and political.
Mm.
And that at the time was not that easy to marry, so to speak. But that was one of the driving forces that got me going. So how do you make a work that is totally pertinent to South Africa and totally pertinent to the very specific political situation that was being lived in that country, but at the same time sort of dialogues with minimalism, conceptual mm-hmm. art, you know, what was being practiced in the early 80s in in Europe and in the United States mainly. That was one main sort of thrust of my thinking and my questioning. I mean, a lot of my art comes out of my questioning. I have questions, and then mm-hmm. I, you know, in my need to answer them or to fulfill gaps, I make works. That's a lot of what happens. And then my other kind of driving force was a biographical one, which was to do with the fact that, you know, as a youngster, I became very aware of the fact that I was a hybrid person, Mozambican born, became a South African citizen, educated in South Africa, married in South Africa, laid down my political and intellectual roots all in that country.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had strong affinities with Portugal as well. So my biographical pull in an intuitive way was about an attempt to establish links between these three points. And in doing that, I kind of suspected that, you know, one would be dealing with the history of colonialism,
mm-hmm.
but also that I was fortuitous in intuitively. I mean, now it all seems clearer, but intuitively, I sort of knew that there were fortuitous things about the fact that, for example, Mozambique reached independence long before South Africa was liberated.
Yeah.
And also the colonial past of Mozambique had been Portuguese rather than Anglo-Saxon. So I, in myself, embodied various colonial spirits and post-colonial spirits, and then that Portugal had this kind of revolution in the 70s, which was at the time a kind of left-wing revolution. So I intuitively felt that there was a lot of political energy that was very interesting between, you know, the links of Mozambique, Portugal, and South Africa.
Yeah.
So I guess in the kind of first question you made about what drove my practice, in many ways at the beginning, and probably, funnily enough, still drives it today, although now it's also been fed with lots of other discourses and events that have taken place. But then you also asked a question about architecture. And that the architecture story kind of overlaps with all that, but comes in at a slightly different point, and in a much more practical sense. So mm-hmm. when I was saying earlier, I've always liked thinking, ever since I was an art student, a lot of my work was not a term that we ever used in the late 70s or early 80s, but my work was already investigative. You know, I remember reading books
mm-hmm.
Before I made works, you know, taking down notes, copying drawings from books. So I guess they're in the sort of origins of an investigative practice. But when I first started thinking about, well, if you want to make political work in South Africa and you want to connect with the people of South Africa, and when I use the people, I mean the broad spectrum of South Africa's population. Mm. In apartheid, as you know, there was a big division between whites and blacks and so on. My kind of milieu was more concentrated on how do you reach all the people in South Africa? So how do you break racial divisions by making art that is meaningful to people, everybody. And so I was looking for reference material that I could somehow connect with visually that was meaningful to everybody. And that wasn't an easy task, because if you have a country that's already so demographically divided into cultures, religions, race, et cetera, what can you find that does break through those divisions and is somehow legible to everybody? And somewhere along the line in the late 80s or maybe around about 90, I came across a program, an urban program, which was called Sites and Services, which was an architectural urban program run by the City Council of Cape Town. And I can describe it later if you want, but maybe just now in a summary. So they, for this program, Sites and Services, little cement dwellings that were toilets were built along vast landscapes. And they were, in fact, architecture in a very broad, what we'd call today, the expanded field of architecture, because they were also sculptural in many ways. And one day I was driving past these and I realized that everybody in South Africa drove past those fields of toilets in the countryside. Mm-hmm. And they were there to house people who were going to come and live in informal dwellings. And I realized that be you rich or poor, white or black, you know, you would know what that was.
Yeah.
You didn't need anybody to decodify that. Mm-hmm. And so I realized that there was architecture which was legible by everybody. And if I started working with images of architecture, I would at least be able to offer anybody who came into an exhibition of mine a starting point, an entry point. You know, they could read the first line.
Yeah.
So that's how it started.
Yeah. Okay. And I heard you using the term sculptural renditions before, and could you elaborate a bit on this term? I thought it was very interesting, and also maybe speak a little bit about the relation between art and research in your work, which you already, of course, touched on. But how do you really proceed in developing the work? In the research phase, or is there a research phase, or in the studio phase, or other phases, or is it all mixed? And how do you proceed there?
Yeah. So rendition. It's a very good and interesting question, and obviously it's about language and linguistics and the meaning of language, but it's also about sculpture and art for me, at least. And I think the word rendition, it was in my vocab already from art school for somewhere along the line. So I became familiar with English as a later adolescence, as I finished school. Mm-hmm. So it's not, you know, it's a language that I was conscious of learning. And ever since I was at art school, I remember the word rendition being, or rendering being, a very useful word, mm-hmm. because it's, you know, people would say, so and so, mostly at the beginning, I think it was related to drawing, if I remember correctly. I hope I'm not kind of embroidering a bit here, but if I remember correctly, it was used related to drawing, and it was always about, somebody rendered the figure very well, or it was used when somebody was making a citation of another drawing. Say, for example, and I've done that over the years many times. Say, I admire Diego Rivera, the muralist, the Mexican muralist.
Yeah.
So at times I've taken drawings that he made and made drawings based on his drawings.
Yeah.
And so I remember the word being used in that way, like you render. This is an Angela Ferreira rendering a Diego Rivera drawing. Mm-hmm. So it's not quite a copy, because you're not tracing on top of his drawing. You're obviously using your own hand, but you're looking at the drawing and you interpreting it as close as possible. You can be very close or not very close, mm-hmm. but there's something about a citation there, but it's a visual citation.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I hope I'm not, I mean, at this point, I would dare say that this could be now my own linguistic definition of rendering, but, and maybe if we go to the dictionary, that might not completely coincide, but that's the way I use it anyway. And I guess that's what you're asking. So,
yes.
That's what's mm-hmm. important. So when I started working with architecture, often I started work, my first research point for the project would be a photographic exercise. So I would go to the site and I would document it extensively. And that I never called rendering. That was just for me, just straight documentation photograph, even though I knew I was going to use them as part of the artwork, that's what they were. But then in the transition that goes between photographing the object, the architectural object, and then sometimes making drawings based on those photographs, and then building an object, mm-hmm. a sculpture, I used to call that rendering, because there would be sculptures where part of the sculpture would be very similar to the building that was being chosen, you know, that I was communicating about. And in that circumstance, I would talk, and this is how I rendered the architectural detail. So where the architectural detail is the closest to reality, I guess, and where one is a observer, as a visitor, is most easily able to enter the recognition game between, I know this building. This is the building on the highway, as you know, on the N2 as you drive into Cape Town. It's on the left-hand mm-hmm. side, that kind of thing. So that component was closer to the actual building, then I would often use the expression rendering. And it's interesting that you say that, because you're not the first person. Nobody's asked me that question for a very long time. But people that have, mostly people who've written about my work, but have wanted to talk to me beforehand. So in conversation, I would say, and then when I rendered this part of Maison Tropicale, or when I decided to render Maison Tropicale, I did this, or I did that, or, and then they would say, render? What do you mean by rendering? So that word has come up, and it is, I think, my own dictionary at the moment. And as I said, don't check up on reality here, because the Oxford Dictionary might say something quite different.
No, very interesting. Interesting. Yeah. And
there was another part to the question.
About the process.
Oh,
art and research and the different, do you have different phases?
Research often goes on the whole time, but it's mostly in the beginning. It's mostly, you know, something would spark, usually an image, but not always an image. Something would spark a curiosity in me for some reason. And then I'll go and dig into it. And sometimes it can be very superficial. It could be just a conversation, like, I don't know, yesterday I was talking to a friend about Dollar Brand's 1973 record that I hadn't heard about called something Space Program, African Space Program.
Okay.
And I was immediately when, because mm-hmm. I like music and I've often used music in my projects, you know, and I love Abdullah Ibrahim, and I remember he used to be called Dollar Brand. I was immediately, oh, this is amazing. So mm-hmm. the research could start with that person, and then I would, you know, spend an hour or two. Well, what do you know about this record? Where is it? What time? When was it edited? Mm-hmm. Look online. Can I see an image? Is there an image of him recording? Is there an image on the cover of the record? And so on. Mm-hmm. So it could start like that, you know. And then if the issue is rich, somehow it starts giving information mm-hmm. and the information isn't somehow the line of work that I see myself developing, I will pursue it. You know, then I'll go into the internet and do a little bit more browsing, and mm-hmm. then I will buy books and I or order films or see films or and so on. So, and it's usually at the beginning of a project, and there's a period that is a very exciting and compelling, sort of like sometimes I feel like I've got a bug, like the research part is compulsive. It's like you mm-hmm. sometimes when it's like time to finish at the end of the day, you still, you know, there's still something else because mm-hmm. as you know, one thing leads to another, especially if you're doing research online, you know.
Exactly.
You're reading one thing and then they point out to somebody else who's written a paper on it and you make a note, and then at the end of the day you've got like 50 things that you, and it's like a nonstop process. So
yeah.
But that is very exciting, and it's also a time when I will you know, if I see images I like, I'll immediately print them in black and white in my printer in the studio, and they'll go up on the wall as, you know, the beginning of a visual, like, relationship, a visual story constructing. It's usually at the beginning. And then at some point there's enough material to invite me to start making something. And that's very, it's unclear to me. And I don't think I can give you an answer to that, because sometimes I'm doing a project for a date. I mean, I have a show, you know, it's mm-hmm. going to open in July, for example, like this one at Angad.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now April and I'm still on the research, and I know that I've got to like stop the research and start making the art, you know.
Yeah, so sometimes you would have to push yourself a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, if I have all the time in the world, it goes at a different pace. It goes at a different pace. But often there are deadlines that one also has to meet, and there's a point at which you have to start committing to something, yeah. you know.
Mm.
But then sometimes because of that, you start committing, but you carry on researching. So you're making sculptures, but you're still researching at the same time, you know, and, that can go on until pretty much the end of the process.
Yeah.
And it depends a lot on whether they're projects that are made in my studio,
mm-hmm.
which of course are around me all the time, and I can keep on building on them as mm-hmm. we go along. Or rather bigger projects. For example, A Tendency to Forget was a huge project. But once I've delivered the drawings to a workshop to make a big work, it's very difficult to, you know, change that. It's workshops have given a budget for building an object. And so that commitment usually has to stay. And you can do research around it, so you can do photographs, you can do drawings, you can do other things that add to the project, but the actual structure has to be fixed, yeah.
yeah.
But the research is an amazing part of practice.
Mm.
Also because my research is not only, even though I'm an academic, it's not dry academic research. Remember, I mean, like, I did a project called For Mozambique, which in it had Bob Dylan playing a song.
Yeah.
So a lot of my research was just listening to amazing music. You know, it's not quite in the always in that academic, harder reading sort of. I ordered all Bob, even the other day, somebody asked me, do you think Bob Dylan deserved to get the Nobel Prize of Literature? Now, I'd read all his poetry book. I said, absolutely. But that, call that research, but it's not, you know, it's also fun research.
Amazing. Yeah, I think it's really interesting what you said about that. It could like go on and on, but at the same time, then there comes this magical moment where it actually transfers back to the work. I think that's super interesting. And yeah, maybe we will talk about this a bit more when talking about your particular works. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a bit about the work at Hangar then. A spontaneous tour of some monuments of African architecture. Can you explain how it came to the title of this exhibition?
Sure. The title is a mouthful, for which I apologize, but I'm not solely to blame for it. So, as I said to you before, I've been on and about architecture for a long time, and I've gone through many different thoughts and critical appraisals of, for example, modernist architecture from colonial periods in Africa. And as you can imagine, I started, you know, my first kind of work that I feel I had traction with Sites and Services, which I just mentioned earlier. That was in 91, very early 90s. Mm-hmm. And so we're now 30 years down the line. And like most artists, your critical abilities remain and your thoughts evolve about a topic and a subject, which is what's happened with architecture and particularly African architecture. So this work is really about my questionings of how I'm relating to this kind of colonial modernist architecture in Africa now. Mm-hmm. But in the title, I wanted to pay homage to an artist who in the 70s was really important in my practice and is important to thousands of artists, and that was Robert Smithson. Mm-hmm. And my favorite Robert Smithson work, which was, and when I say my favorite, it's always to do with learning. It was probably the work that I discovered of his where I learned the most at the time I encountered it in the late 70s, because he was about seeing structures around him in a poetic way, structures that were not poetic, like sewage pipes, mm-hmm. in a poetic way. And so my favorite work of his is Monuments to the Passaic. Mm-hmm. And when I finished this project for Hangar and I was kind of dwelling on a title, I went back to Smithson and I went and looked more profoundly into the work, did some research, and I found that the work wasn't originally called Monuments to the Passaic. It was rather called A Spontaneous Tour of Some Monuments to the Passaic. Mm-hmm. That's the full title of Robert Smithson's work. And I all of a sudden realized that he, by using that title, he was enhancing the fact that what he was doing was going along, seeing things, taking a photograph, thinking about them, going along, seeing something else, mm-hmm. taking a photograph, thinking some more, going along, seeing something new, adding information to the previous information. So building a kind of discourse about these sewage pipes and leftover industrial structures on the River Passaic. And I thought, well, that's exactly what I've been doing about my thoughts on architecture. So in the specifically to do with architecture in Africa and in, you know, focusing on the modernist stuff. And so that's where the mouthful comes from. And that's why it's not totally my, I'm not totally to blame for this long-winded title, but it does describe an ongoing thinking process that I like very much.
So, Miriam McKay was housed in, Dalaba.
I interrupt with something? Sorry, before you ask your next question. Maybe I'm anticipating, but maybe I should explain a little bit more how that present exhibition reflects on my ongoing thoughts about architecture in Africa, or is that too early on in our conversation?
No, go ahead.
Can I?
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess it comes quite nicely, you know, as a consequence of what we were talking about, Smithson.
Mm-hmm.
So having done so much work on modernist architecture in Africa, and most of the modernist architecture dated from the colonial period and was in that way, there were quite ugly memories of that colonial presence. Even though the buildings themselves were often stunningly beautiful, they had that duality to them. But, you know, something I was also very aware of over the years is that these very same buildings, they were the result of the last of colonial efforts to colonize.
Yeah.
But they were also the buildings that were inhabited by the governments that inherited those countries.
Mm-hmm.
So they were also the buildings that saw the beginning of the new countries, the birth of the new countries, the new utopian building, nation building exercises, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were odd in that they represented both the worst of the end of colonialism and often the best of those periods of the state of grace of the new utopic African countries, the liberation, the liberation wars having been won, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, time goes along, and every time I visit Mozambique, for example, which is the country I do visit the most, I re-enter these modernist buildings. And I have, for the last 5 or 10 years, been thinking, people are living in these buildings in a different way. They are not necessarily the symbol of that horrible colonial presence anymore,
mm-hmm.
mainly because the colonial presence was 50 years ago. So, mm-hmm. you know, 50 years is half a century. New generations have been born,
mm-hmm.
and new generations inhabit buildings in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
They don't necessarily know all the history, you know. So they go and get their passport at a beautiful-looking modernist building designed by a Portuguese architect in 1958.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody who's 18 or 20 in Mozambique now doesn't really care all that much for those details, you know, and that list of symbols, political mm-hmm. symbols. And
Interesting. Can I just ask, would you mm-hmm. see it then as a kind of transformation of the architecture?
Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. And that's why I was bringing it up now, because mm-hmm. that's really what led to the project, a spontaneous tour of some monuments of African architecture,
mm-hmm.
is I was once again looking at a modernist building. In this case, it was an airport. And then I started looking, and I've been, you know, using the airports in Mozambique a lot, because I arrive by plane and I leave by plane. So I'm familiar with airports, and I was familiar with it since I was born, you know. And so I've witnessed the kind of use of airports from being a colonial child to now, you know, 50 years after independence. And people have, in a way, depoliticized that part of the history, and rightly so, because if you think about it, this particular airport that I'm using in this show was built in Nampula, was built, I think, 8 years before independence came.
Mm-hmm.
So if you and I were there today, that building is only used, it's 60 years old, but only 8 years were used for colonial purposes, you know, which means the building has gained so much more history, you know, beyond its colonial purpose. And anybody who's younger than me, will 10 or 20 years younger than me, doesn't really have the memory to go back to 1975 when independence happened. Mm. And so I started thinking, you know, I don't want to be calling these buildings modernist colonial architecture in Africa. I just want to be calling them African architecture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's it. You know, why should they always, of course, we won't forget where they come from, but why do we have to like restrict it to that definition, which was in fact very short? And the buildings have been inhabited and transformed, often in very interesting ways, you know.
Mm-hmm.
For example, they would be used in colonial times mainly for the white settlers. And now they certainly are not exclusive to, you know, I'm talking about public buildings, you know,
yeah.
If you go to the city council or if you go to a hospital, you know, they're buildings which are community buildings, you know, in a much broader sense. Yeah, so that's, you know, and it's in the spirit of Smithson, who adds information. You know, he goes along and he takes one picture, as I was saying, adds information. So my exercise with architecture in Africa at the moment, African architecture, is about how do I look at all this colonial architectural legacy as just being part of African architecture, you know? It's a question that I don't have answered. It was my first proposal. So my exhibition at Ngaad, the buildings are very, the structures are very hybrid. Mm-hmm. They are modernist and traditional. So there's like references to traditional architecture made with bamboo and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's cement structures, you know, and glass. And that's it, that's where I am at the moment, kind of like fathoming out what is African architecture in this mm-hmm. case now? How do we constitute it? You know, I mean, mm-hmm. I'm sure other countries have had to reckon with this. You know, how does Germany, for example, deal with Nazi architecture? You know, mm-hmm. is it just Nazi architecture or is it German architecture mm-hmm. built in a particular time with a particular meaning? You know, that interests me. That's what that project is about. And that's why that title of Smithson's was so important.
Yeah.
It's a tour I'm making. I haven't arrived yet.
Yeah. Very interesting. If the buildings are, it just came to my mind. If the buildings are depoliticized, what happens then to the idea of utopia, the former idea? But that's just what just came to my mind. Maybe you could speak a little bit more about the different elements in the exhibition, and also in general. I had this question. I was wondering what do the different media, what roles do they play in your work? The different formats, the different medias, and how do you use them? And does it change from work to work?
Just so your very first question, if mm-hmm. I, again, please help me along with if I forget a part of the question.
Sure.
I don't think the buildings have been depoliticized. I think they're just politicized in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that buildings are made for communities. They're made for people to use them. And I think they are actually politically better used now than they were in colonial times. But it's a different kind of politicization. I do think they are still very political in my reading. And it's interesting that you ask in that line of thought, it's interesting that you ask about the different materials mm-hmm. and the different media, because that exhibition, A Spontaneous Tour Through Some Monuments of African Architecture, is all about hybridity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's all, everything is hybrid. There is not one sculpture or one object that isn't hybrid, that has, you know, brings in traditional architecture, it brings in modernist architecture, it brings in, as I said, cement and glass at the same time as other more traditional materials. But then it's also in my work always complemented with other mediums, which can vary. And I have not left those yet, although I suppose there's already quite a lot of mediums if I think about it. In this case, there's no sound.
Mm-hmm.
But I have been known to work a lot with sound. But it would always have, or mostly have, drawings, photographs, video is something I've used a lot. Again, not in this particular exhibition at the Angaar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because those are the, as we were talking earlier, those other mediums are often the spaces where I have more freedom to continue researching and investigating whilst I'm making the sculptures,
mm-hmm.
Because they're more immediate. You know, a video I can literally edit until 2 days before the opening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know,
right.
And you, I mean, you probably work with video as well, and you will know there's a final version, and then next week you do another final version, and then 2 days later there's another final version. And the same applies for sound. And drawing is the most immediate and easy thing to do because you basically can do it anywhere. You can do it at home after dinner on the table. You can do it at the studio. You can do it if you travel. So, and I, my drawings are often small, A4, because they're transportable. And then with photography, there's different levels. There's some projects which have a photographic component in a very self-conscious way. A Maison Tropicale has it. A Tendency to Forget has it. So photographs that I wanted to be part of the installation, and they are fixed part of the installation. I would go to a place. I would take the photographs with a good camera. I would then have them printed, glued, or, you know, framed, and that would be part of the installation.
Mm-hmm.
But then I also, you know, I will just print a photostat on my Xerox machine and put that in a frame.
Mm.
When I want to have information, that information available, and I'm not very precious about, I will print a black and white picture of Miriam Makeba and put it on the wall, you know,
mm-hmm.
Or Nancy Holt's sculpture that I just want the viewer, oh, remember this and remember that. And, you know, I just like to remind you that there's this detail here for you to think about. And those I do with no problem at all. I don't see them as in any way inferior but obviously I don't consider them fixed components of the installation. They can vary.
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, it's possible that if you can imagine that a tour, the project a tour, maybe a curator wants to show one sculpture in an exhibition, you know, not the whole set of sculptures. I might send the sculpture with, instead of 30 little photographs on the wall, I might select 8 or 9, and then that'll be one sort of component, if you know what I mean. They're usually about my nonstop compulsive need to communicate with my viewer.
Okay, yeah.
I'm when I put up an exhibition, I'm always thinking, well, will the viewer understand this? Will am I saying what I want to say? And how does somebody, you know, that very same thing that I told you from the very first day when I started working in 1987 or whatever it was, that was, how do I find a piece of architecture that everybody can recognize? That very same drive is still there. And that's why those lots and lots of little drawings and images on the wall appear. Oh, because how will they know that Miriam Makeba started this whole process? And how will they know that I didn't look only at Robert Smithson, although I love Robert Smithson's work, but he also had a partner called Nancy Holt, who also made some wonderful, you know, modernist land pieces. So yeah. I'm kind of telling people how I'm building my thoughts.
To pull them into your head.
Yeah, and always desperate to like share them with everybody else. Yes. I think sometimes there may be a bit too much, but that's what it is. That's where I go.
But you do enjoy having the conversation with the audience also, for example, in the exhibition, in the openings, because there are some artists who are really don't like that at all.
Yeah,
right?
No, I'm all about the communication of it and the sharing. Sharing has been very much part of my, in fact, it's funny that you ask that because, you know, the little strips of lots of frames on the wall, which have Nancy Hold, Mary Makeba, the Mozambican architect, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In my studio, when I want to get help to put those together, I always talk about, I'm now constructing the conversation. And everybody that helps me in the studio knows the conversation is always all this other stuff that I have to bring into my installations to communicate with people. It is the conversation, you know. So I call it the conversation, although it never appears in any document or but amongst myself and the person who helps me at the studio, it's the conversation. And we often say, so where's the conversation for Miriam Makeba? Or where's the conversation? And that just means the pile of drawings that goes with that project.
Nice way to use the term conversation. So I really want to speak to you a little bit more about the hybridity, as you already mentioned that. And obviously you are mixing references in the sculptures for this exhibition. Maybe it's time to go a little bit back to Miriam Makeba, what I was wanting to ask you before. So just for the audience to understand, the house in Dalaba, in Guinea-Conakry, how did you come to that? How did it inspire you? Also with the previous work, Sol d'Exil from 2019. Mm-hmm. And how are these two works related in the end?
Yeah. Good question, because it's also important to say, and I don't think I've transmitted that to you yet, is that one work always also feeds into the next work. You know, they're not blocked things that you close off and throw away the key. They're like conversations that go on. Again, Miriam Makeba, you know, I've known about Miriam Makeba. So I grew up in South Africa, so Miriam Makeba was there as an important part. Somewhere in my previous research, and I can't remember exactly where, but I came across Rogozin's film where Miriam Makeba, which caused the reason why Miriam Makeba was kicked out of South Africa. So it was a story that was in my imagination, also growing up there and being a girl growing up there and that amazing voice she has. You know, we all knew Miriam had been, her passport had been removed when she traveled abroad, and she could never come back to South Africa until Nelson Mandela was in power. And somewhere in my research, I'd found out that the reason why she was kicked out was because she was in a film which was made illegally in South Africa by a guy called, whose surname was Rogozin, in which she stars in the film, and she goes to Venice, I think, to promote the film.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And the film is met with a lot of acclaim, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then the South African government withdraws her passport and thereby impedes her from coming back to South Africa. So this is a story of somebody I, you know, admired and was curious about, and had gone a little bit into it. And then at the time, there were two other things that came to mind. The one was a story about a guy called George Wright, who had escaped, he was a Black Panther member, escaped America in an incredible story, which I can't tell now because I'm not sure that's what you want us to want me to tell now. But he ended up in Guinea, the Guinea-Bissau, not Conakry. And he became, he was an escapee from America, but he married a Portuguese woman, lived in Guinea, for many years, and became a Portuguese citizen, and eventually did escape the American authorities that way. And so Guinea was like on my mind about this George Wright, Georges Dos Santos. And then I saw a documentary which was about Miriam Makeba. And I saw it online as, you know, what we see, Netflix, whatever, whatever. And in this whole documentary about Miriam Makeba, there was a small portion which was about the fact that when she, you know, after she was exiled, she went to New York and then married Stokely Carmichael, who was a Pan-Africanist and a Black Panther. And they'd gone to Conakry, and all of a sudden things started clicking together. Guinea again coming up, and now, but it's not Guinea-Bissau, it's the one across the border, Conakry. And then the whole story about Sekou Touré, who had invited her to come there, and he'd said, choose a spot where you want to build a house, and she decided to build a house in Dalaba, which is a small town about 300 kilometers inland from Conakry itself. And in the documentary, her grandchild, I think it's his, her grandchild, visits the house again because he had lived there with her as a little pick.
Okay.
And I, all of a sudden, and you know, the documentary explains a lot about the beginnings of her talking about how she chose Dalaba because it reminded her of the landscape around Johannesburg, where she'd come from. And she was not allowed to go to South Africa, so this reminded her. And yeah, and all of a sudden I thought, oh my gosh, a house, you know, an architectural structure. And then a woman who was an activist and an artist, the singer, she was exiled. She wanted to make a life for herself in Africa. She took a whole family there. She managed to run her incredible career and be an activist for many, many years in Conakry from Dalaba. In this, and all of a sudden, this house, as you would say, was politicized for me. You know, it became like a symbol of exile and a symbol of a woman who was like fighting to be a constructive, creative African person, you know, on the continent. And yeah, so I decided to do a project on the house. But that house also got me started. It's a very unique house. Because, and it's unique because its structure is African traditional. So it's a cylinder with a cone on top. And in architectural terms, you talk about cone on cylinder architecture. I didn't know until then, but then I went to read quite a lot about traditional African architecture, and it's a term used. And, but it's not built of temporary materials. It's built of cement. And it has a corrugated iron roof. In fact, it has got two cones on it. So already there, it's a hybrid between a kind of structure that is essentially an African architectural structure, the cylinder with a cone on top, but built in modern material, 20th century materials, what you would, one would say. And then the interior of the house have got these incredible basketry, traditional Conakry details, but the whole ceilings are like that. And it's those ceilings that appear in a spontaneous tour of some monuments of African architecture. Because it's when I'm analyzing that house that I all of a sudden realize, okay, so this is no longer the like pure little beautiful modernist, you know, buildings built in Africa that looked like the Bauhaus or whatever. This is actually a true hybrid piece of architecture. The front of the house is like a modernist entrance, like it looks like a hotel entrance, but then it's got the cone roof and then inside the beautiful basketry, you know. So that's when I started thinking, hello, this is no longer the little pure modernist exercises. This is much more complex, much more hybrid, and much more interesting as like a model to think of contemporary African architecture, you know? And that's kind of, so a tour, the project, a tour literally follows from Dalaba Sol d'Exil. The one project, you know, really comes out of the other.
Yeah.
And in fact, in my studio, I still have all the images of the Dalaba house up, you know, and people asking, but why is this 3 years ago? Yeah, but it's very important.
So you're still working on
I'm still
on
there.
That.
I'm still thinking.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. Yeah, super interesting. Cool. Yeah. Let's see. Yeah. Talking about Miriam Makeba and what you said about her personal biography about coming and going to Africa, not being able, being in exile. There's this Ghanaian scholar, Ato Kwesen, and he discusses Africa as intertwined in very close relation with this kind of coming and going. And he calls that African diasporization. So the continuous movement of migration and return. And I was wondering also, in terms of your own biography, I mean, obviously you have been migrating between different places, born in Mozambique, South Africa, Portugal. Can you share some of the reflections, maybe artistic or personal? About these transitions between the different cultural spheres, the different perspectives. Does that speak to you in a way?
Yeah, sure. Beautiful question. I'd love to write down the name of the Ghanaian thinker that you mentioned. So
yes, Ato Kwesen. Yes, sure.
To share that. Very much so. I mean, one of the, as I said, you know, my own biography has been not that I've done it consciously, but you can't escape yourself. You know, you are only yourself, mm-hmm. so you can't really escape yourself. But the idea of movement has been very important in mm-hmm. my life. Mm-hmm. And the crisscrossing of the movements, as I said before, you know, the fact that it wasn't just Anglo-Saxon colonialism or wasn't just Portuguese colonialism, you know, it was these things crisscross, and my history and my way of looking at things has been enriched by those crisscrossings. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that amazed me about Miriam Makeba's life was precisely that. In fact, I made some maps at one point, some drawings that were maps about how she went from Johannesburg to Venice, and then Venice to New York,
oh, wow.
and then New York to Conakry, and then eventually when Sékou Touré became very nasty and she got terrified, she left and went to live in Brussels, and then finally from Brussels she came back to live in Johannesburg, where she passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So a life that has crisscrossed, and I started thinking of how many African people do have these amazing traveling lives that are enriched as they go along, but more than that, that they are also enriched when they cross one another, you know, the intersections mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. What you are calling, and I would also call, diasporic African thinkers, African artists, mm-hmm. African workers, immigrants, you know, the crisscrossing that goes along, and the learnings that are shared and go to build a kind of rich hybrid and not necessarily nationalistic African identity, you know,
mm-hmm.
that fascinated and fascinates me. And a little while ago, I started looking back a lot again at Pan-Africanism because of that, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, there you have a moment where, the idea of a sense of internationalism in Africa was mm-hmm. being explored. And somehow by the time I came to being or becoming aware of African politics, which was in the '80s, that had become, or at least in South Africa, I can't speak of the whole of Africa, but at least in South Africa, it had become like a non-interesting topic. You know, Pan-Africanism was something that, you know, in the 60s, the Pan-Africanists lived and they wrote and they thought, you know, now we were in the 80s fighting apartheid and there was the African National Congress, which was definitely not Pan-Africanism, you know. And somehow I'd kind of disengaged with that option. But once I started thinking of all people crossing and thinking and sharing thoughts, I thought, well, maybe Pan-Africanism is something to be said, you know, about that potential of that internationalism. And in fact, my project, Pan-African Unity Mural, comes from that idea. I was also very inspired, now that you mention African thinkers, at the time, I was very inspired by a talk I'd heard by Achille Mbembe about intersections. And he didn't necessarily just talk about intersections, but his talk kind of got me going on how movements also happened in Africa before there were borders, you know, and how people's communications happened in a much freer way, and where people intersected, you know, where roots intersected were like places of exchange and gaining knowledge, you know, and yes, and so the whole of Pan-African Unity Mural was taking Miriam Makeba, myself, and George Wright, the person I was talking to about, because he, unlike Miriam and myself, who were both born in Africa, George Wright was born in America, in the southern states, and traveled from there to Detroit, then traveled by hijacking a plane from Miami via Boston to Algeria. Then from Algeria, he went to France. From France, he came to Lisbon. And from Lisbon, he went to Guinea-Bissau and finally back in Lisbon, where he still lives.
Wow.
So I had these three personalities, myself, Miriam, and Georges Dos Santos. And I started making maps. That project, Pan-African Unity Mural, starts from maps, like how, you know, that I had a little bit of America and a little bit of Mozambique and a little bit of South Africa drawn, and Conakry and Brussels and Lisbon. And then I was like drawing arrows to understand. And then you start visualizing the crisscrossing that, that was going on. So, that's how Pan-African Unity Mural, arrived for me, you know, and thinking of a possible, more international sense of Africanness, you know, which I don't have an answer for. It's just a question I'm putting out. Sure I'm answering your question.
Oh, yeah, that was very, very interesting. Well, I think that is also somehow articulated in the Maison Tropicale when I heard you speaking about a sense of transit that you wanted to create with these sculptures that are ready for transport, so to speak. And I think, in general, these kind of transcultural relations that you are in, movements that you are speaking about, are very visible in your work and in the discussions we have about it. I just wanted to go back a little bit to the photographs you mentioned in the beginning. You spoke about taking photographs as documentations on the one hand, or printing them and hanging them as references. But then in Maison Tropicale, you have this really work, which actually plays a big part in my view, in the end, where you took photographs of the concrete remains of the actual buildings, right? So can you tell us a little bit more about these places and how they are today and what is left?
Yeah. In fact, you're right. In Maison Tropicale, although I worked with photographs very early on of the buildings, and there again, well, that's an interesting question that we come back to this, the one of our first thoughts here today. With Maison Tropicale, I had all the documentation of the building. I'd even gone to Paris to see the house, so I was very familiar with what I was going to work with. But I had a difficult issue, which was, I cannot render this house into something similar to what it was, using the word rendering again.
Yes.
Because I knew that if I rendered the house in a similar way, I would just be celebrating the selling of the house and the bringing it back to Europe and the auction and the stealing it from Africa, which is what really happened. So I knew that the way I needed to render the house was not as it was. So I took it apart and put it in the container. And the idea was that it was always in transit, you know. So the parts of the house are built in exactly the same size as Prouvaire designed them. They are one to one. But because they're stacked like in a cupboard, you know, which is a container, they are the real house, but they're not the real house. Yeah. They're this other thing that can move around. But once I'd actually resolved that part of the project, I was faced with another problem, which was a very personal problem. I felt like a kind of artist voyeur that was doing an exercise on this odd story that had happened with these houses. And I had this niggling feeling that my project wasn't complete somehow. And although I designed, I was very happy with the sculpture and everything, and I didn't alter it, but somehow the project wasn't complete. So, you know, then I went back to the research. And as I was researching again, I realized that Prouvaire also designed the cement bases that the houses rested on. So knowing a bit about architecture and how architects work, I'd suspected that, and I went and researched. And it was confirmed. I found the drawings that Prouvaire had made of the cement bases. He never went to Africa. It was all designed here and sent over there. But so all of a sudden I thought, okay, well, so he designed those cement bases. Those cement bases are just as much a part of the house, of the architecture, as the top part. Just as a foundation is also part of this building. You don't see it, but it's part of it, you know. And then I started thinking, oh, well, how could they have stolen? They couldn't have stolen the cement parts because, you know, that would have been a little bit more complicated to steal. So then I realized, okay, then the cement parts must still be there in their places. And they are the proof of the removal, you know, like cemeteries are the proof that somebody's underground, you know, that there's a body underground. And so we did some research with Google Maps and, you know, contacted people in Niamey and in Brazzaville, and we vaguely could tell where the houses had been placed. And we asked people, could you go there and just take a reconnaissance photograph? And we started realizing, oh my gosh, the cement bases are all there.
Wow.
You know? And so that's when I said to the poor curator, like a month before the Biennale opened, I said, I have bad news for you. And he said, why? And I said, well, we have to go to Africa, not once, but twice, because we have to go to two different places. There was a house in Niamey in Niger and two in Brazzaville. So we went. And yeah, and somehow that completed the project for me. You know, it was kind of testament of where they had been. The rationale for it comes not as early research, but as kind of a consequence of the process.
That goes back to my question from the beginning where I asked about where is the research taking place.
Exactly.
I said it's the beginning, but it's really this kind of magical conversation between the research and the art that keeps like going back and forth in
the
way.
It does, yeah. And it's really very rewarding as an artist.
Really nice. So, finally, I wanted to speak to you a little bit more about hybridity in general. I was wondering, since you are an artist that has already been working for so many years and always in the context, placed in the context of post-colonial studies, even though you don't work as an academic, but this pops up all the time. I was just wondering of about your thoughts on hybridity as an idea, this kind of identity of the in-between and the mixture, and or as Derrida also called it, brisure, the breaking and joining at the same time. Mm-hmm. These concepts are quite, they have been there for a while, right? Mm-hmm. So, and we still use them. So I was wondering, do you see any changes? Is there, like if you would compare your work maybe in the 90s to today, your practice as an artist, have there been changes? And then also regarding the, of course, the whole idea of, which you already touched on, post-colonial Ethiopian independence area compared to maybe a more contemporary decolonial endeavors that we are trying to develop, and also how can we develop where you see us going?
Mm.
Sorry.
That's the difficult That's the difficult one. I'll do my best. I think hybridity has come a long way, mm-hmm. and it's still very much there. I could say, even though I may be contentious, but I would say I'm pleased to say that it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly, I guess, as a profoundly hybrid person, you know, that's why I'm saying I'm pleased to say, because it would be very sad to be at this point in my practice and say, well, that's no longer valid as a concept, you know. But yes, I think that it has gone through many different stages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I started working in the 90s, both in South Africa and in Portugal, the sense of hybridity was quite different. I mean, in Portugal, there was no space for hybridity at that time. So I really had to carve the way through an art world here that had not given much thought to the hypothesis that somebody who's African in spirit comes to practice in Europe and demands a space,
mm-hmm.
whatever that space is.
Mm-hmm.
In South Africa, hybridity in the 80s and early 90s was obviously much more to do with interracial relationships,
yeah.
and cultural issues of interraciality. You know, how do you bring together Western thought and African thought? How do you,
yeah.
bring together African thinkers that are politically thinking often based on European philosophy, like you mentioned Derrida, mm. you know, or even thinkers like Fanon, who mm. was educated in France and, you know, obviously brought a train of French philosophy and psychological thought into his own sort of African ideals. Mm. So hybridity was quite different in my belief. Then
mm-hmm.
comes a time when the whole spirit of multiculturalism becomes sort of
mm-hmm.
into the discussion and becomes acceptable and desirable. And where hybridity is no longer a taboo, you don't have to explain it. It is, you know, you become more, I felt that I became more of a representative of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
way of thinking or possibility of thinking, if one can call it that. I always intuitively, knew I was hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
I knew in my early 20s, my main problems as a growing person to become a person had been about resolving the hybridity and coming to terms mm-hmm. with the goodness of it, rather than seeing it as a negative thing, which it can be.
Yeah,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to paint it as a as a wonderful, you know, privileged thing that you're hybrid and you can do this and you can do that. But it's also a really painful thing to deal with because you don't feel you belong very, very well anywhere.
Exactly.
So that intuitively, I kind of knew that that was my role. That was the only role I could have. And that's why I mentioned right at the beginning that I had this intuition that I could triangulate between Portugal, South Africa, and Mozambique, because that's what I knew my road was. I will never be a South African 100% because I'm not, you know, and I will never be a Mozambican 100% because I'm not. And neither will I always be Portuguese 100% because I'm not. So I intuitively felt that I could bridge those, attempt for myself to bridge those gaps, and that's what I've done. And of course, recently, in the light of the new, more decolonial discourses, as you put it, and where African voices or African descendant voices in Portugal, for example, have gained a lot more traction and a lot more space, both in art, but also a little bit in politics in Portugal.
Mm-hmm.
Not enough, alas, but still the signs are there. There has been a kind of, every now and again, I sense that there has been a tendency to radicalize the discourse of blackness and Africanness, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But I still see, even within that, and I understand that that's a very necessary thing, because that's how you gain space, is you radicalize, you fight for something, and you gain space. I think that space is there to be gained, and I welcome it. However, I have not felt that my role as somebody who can do something different, which is establish links in a different way, is useful and feels I have ground, constructive ground to work on.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, just to give you an example, because I have worked hard to keep working in South Africa, keep working in Mozambique. I work with a gallery in Mozambique, you know, and working in Lisbon. I am very well connected with the Portuguese art scene, and I'm fairly well connected with the other art scenes on the continent as well. And that's my role, is to keep those connections going and establish those bridges if they are there, you know, and when they are there and they're constructive ones. Obviously, destructive bridges are not point and having, you know, but constructive bridges are there. So once again, I see the more radicalized discourse at the moment important to gain ground in Portugal, for example, but I also see it quite isolated from the rest of the contemporary art world in Portugal. And I think that at some point that will be problematic and they will have to be resolved. You know, there can't be two operating side by side. It's going to be difficult for two areas to coexist. I'm not an exclusivizing person. I'm all about inclusivity. I was educated to be, I'm not a racist. I will not collaborate with any racist discourse, whatever it is. And I will not collaborate with any discourse that isn't inclusive in the broadest sense of the word inclusive. Again, be it race, be it financial being, be it status, be it national, you know, there are no lesser nations and more nations and bigger nations or better nations. So in many ways, I sort of feel my hybridity is still a the path of my work and my ethos as a human being. Is that enough?
Yes, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. I am, that's my very personal interest in developing this idea of hybridity, or, you know, thinking about it today and how it has changed. That's why I could go on forever to talk about it. Super interesting what you're saying. I think I just wanted to come to final questions, and that has to do more with your educational work as a teacher. Mm. I was wondering if your teaching does relate to your art making and vice versa, but also, and correct me if I'm wrong, but also this exemplification of your work as a counter narrative or a counter visuality, speaking with Niklas Mirzov, do you transport that in your teaching? Do you use your work as an archive for your teachings, or how do you design that in general?
Yeah. Again, that's something I've been thinking of quite a bit more lately. Mm-hmm. I think, again, my teaching was something that just happened and started happening, kept going and going, and then it became a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
The answer is yes, but probably not in the way that is expected. I believe in teaching as a way of delivering people.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't believe that I would deliver any art student if I was to be solely concerned with impregnating my own beliefs as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
So my approach to teaching art, which is all that I teach really, is about helping students find their own paths. And delivering them to do that in a critical, adult, inclusive manner.
Mm.
So yes, no, I will not tolerate discourses that are, as I said, racist, not inclusive, and so on. Mm. But other than that, I am there to listen to what they want to do and the issues that interest them. And it could be fashion, it could be sex, it could be gender problems, it could be old stories and myths about Portugal. It could be anything.
Mm-hmm.
That students, I don't have topics that are taboos, and I don't have topics that are favorites. And certainly my own work and my own discourse as an artist is not favored. It is there in the background. I don't talk about my work to my students. I don't use it as an example of good art ever. But I
That's
draw.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, but I draw from it profoundly. Mm-hmm. For example, when I travel, for example, I go and see shows, and the main reason why I see shows is to learn about other artists that I can reference to my students.
Oh, great.
Mm-hmm. When this pandemic, one of the things that I've just discovered is going back to teaching this year's. Hey, there's like, how come I've only got like references from artists I saw 2 years ago? And then all of a sudden I realized, oh, I know why. It's because, you know, I stopped traveling and I stopped refilling the, and then I had to like start looking at publications and other things and doing other ways because there's nothing more easy to reference than you've seen a show, you've seen the work of a person on the wall or on the floor or in the video. So you've materially seen it. You've had some feelings about it.
Yeah.
A student comes and says, oh, you should go and look at that. And you can talk about that work as a real emotive thing that you've experienced, you know.
Yeah.
And then they can reference it or not. It's up to them. So yes and no. I mean, I teach from a profoundly ethical, inclusive approach, but I do not. I think I've only presented my own work at the university where I teach once.
Wow. Amazing.
And that was by student demand.
Okay.
Actually,
wow.
They demanded.
Nice. Okay. Yes. Angela, thank you so much. I wish we can continue the conversation.
We will.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Lovely questions. Okay. Enjoyed that very much. You worked hard because you had to go and find all the stuff about my work.
That's really, really interesting. Thank you so much.